he's going to tell us all about how we're going to raise wheat yields by 70% in spite of global climate change. So I think we're all anxious to find out how to do that. Hans is from CIMMYT. So there you go.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And it's a great pleasure to be here. And as somebody said to me this morning, I mean, are you serious about the 70% or you just wanted to attract a lot of people? Well, let me say I'm deadly serious about it, because I think the challenges are ahead. If we want to take the more than 1 billion people out of extreme poverty, we have to produce more food. And just for your information, the UK, the private and public sector together, has launched recently what they call the 2020 program, which means that they want to raise the yield potential in wheat over the next 20 years from currently 12 to 20 tons, and that's an 80% increase. So I think others talk about it also. Left is forward. Okay, first to start with, I mean, why do we have to increase wheat yield by so much? Wheat is the most important food crop in the world and the second most important food crop in the developing world. It provides food for 2.5 billion poor people, 20% of all calories and protein in developing countries. It's the main staple of an estimated 1.2 billion and who have less than $2 per day. It provides income to farmers in 80 developing countries, and wheat is also the most traded crop. And here, just to give you an idea, this is how important wheat is as a calorie source. Red indicates the countries where wheat is the most important calorie source and from plants, and yellow the second one, and blue the third one. So, I mean, wheat is definitely on a global scale paramount for food security, together with rice and maize. But there are real issues for global food security. First of all, the demand for wheat is tremendously increasing. There are projections that by 2050 the demand will increase by 70%, and that's why I put the 70%. The production lags behind demand. There were, in 6 out of the last 10 years, the global wheat production was lower than the consumption. I don't need a PhD in economy to predict that this is not sustainable. And finally, the financial realities in the first world breadbaskets and on global financial markets do no longer tally with what the poor in developing countries need. In many countries, developing countries, people spend more than 35% to 40% on food. With other words, and since they buy the raw material of wheat, they don't provide buy processed products. If the wheat price doubles, that has a major impact on how they on their income and what they spend it. For the real poor, it means they cannot send children to schools anymore. So that needs to be really, really changed fast. And here you can see on the right side development in real wheat prices and what happened over the last 2 years on the bottom in terms of the food index. So this has tremendous impact on the poor, and we need to address. And one way of addressing it is to have enough production. Where is the future wheat production coming from? New areas. There is a lot of talk that the northern hemisphere are benefiting from it. Climate change compensation in the developed world is unlikely to feed the developing world. First of all, in particular after the last year's experience, where a minor change in the global wheat production really caused tremendous, tremendous sparks in global wheat prices, most countries which depend on wheat have a policy to be self-sufficient. So they would not rely on others to provide it to start with, and that needs to be considered. Secondly, the transportation costs. Wheat is really a must product. And then certainly also, if the cultivated soils, for example in Siberia, are going to be cultivated, they will become more, well, dark, and that will mean they warm up more, and that will release more methane, which again means more problems for global climate change. And it has also been just mentioned, it is clear that with global climate change, also new pests and diseases are coming, which have a big impact on wheat and other crop production. However, this is where we are currently. This is a comparison of the average yield 92-99 versus 2000-2008. And there are a couple of countries which actually experienced negative growth, Australia because of extended drought. But you look at all the other countries. This is where we should be in order to have a sustainable production, and most of the major wheat producing countries are very clearly below. So that means we have to increase our wheat production, otherwise there will be major famines around the world. Okay, now where is raising the wheat productivity by 70% coming from? There has been a study by Brunsmann, and he showed that if the major wheat producing countries would produce, take the best technology available, they could have agroecological attainable yields which are 85% higher than today. So there we would be already, if everything would be optimum above the 70% today. Fisher had looked into the 20 major wheat growing regions of the world and have identified an average yield gap of about 40%. That could be closed. Wheat diseases and pests, a global loss of about 28%. Post-harvest losses. Really nobody talks very much about it. In maize it's a big issue. Nobody has very much looked in the losses in developing countries. So I only put 20%. I think it's a conservative estimate. And then finally, based on some models at this time, the yield potential of wheat could be increased by about 50%, and I will come back on this one in particular later. So, in theory, we are already there. In reality, there is still a very, very long way to go. This here is what I just referred to. These are some of the major wheat-producing countries. Missing are the number one and number two, unfortunately, China and India. Nevertheless, this was a study which looked into the agroecological attainable yields for wheat. And what you can see is there are three countries which currently have higher yields than they should. And the reason for this is that they produce mainly wheat in the most productive areas. But all the other countries have tremendous gaps. I mean, you can look at in Romania, it's nearly 140%. But even in the US, it's about 100%. So that means bringing better technology, bringing better agronomy, and bringing better varieties to farmers will help tremendously to close the yield gap. And I took the production of these countries, and that is currently these countries together produce about 50% of the global wheat production. And if the agroecological attainable yields would be achieved, they would produce 85% more, 570 million tons. This here is the picture on global diseases and pests. On a global scale, we still today lose about 30% in spite of all the fungicides, in spite of all the disease-resistance breeding, in spite of all the herbicide application, 30%. And this is lower in the very intensive regions of Europe. You can see there the losses are about 10%. But across the world, the losses are roughly 28%. And that is an area where breeding for resistance, disease resistance, and better agronomy, wheat control in particular, could help. Still about 15% of wheat yield is lost due to insufficient wheat control. And this here is the big challenge for wheat. You just saw a similar map, and I think Mala has also pointed out all the limitations. But I think one thing is for sure, the global climate will change, and it will get warmer. And these are the areas which you see the biggest impact, and that is in particular in the wheat-growing regions in the developing world. The regions which are possibly heavily affected is the subcontinent, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Nepal. And this is where in 2050, every fourth citizen on Earth is going to live. 2.2 billion people will live there by 2050. So this is really also where CIMIT now puts a lot of attention, how we can solve the food production area in this region. And for your information, just 2 weeks ago, the government of India and CIMIT have signed an agreement to establish the Borlaug Institute for South Asia. The government of India have given three research stations in the three different agroecological zones of India for 100 years lease to CIMIT, and CIMIT will now start to establish centers there, and these centers have diplomatic status and are open for cooperation, whoever really is interested and could contribute to the food production in South Asia, public or private. Okay, but now, I just showed here, this is global warming. But if we look at what recently happened, In the Horn of Africa, everybody aware, right, there is a serious drought. In Niger, for example, however, there is also a drought. In Mexico, frost in February and September this year have caused more than 5 million tons loss in maize. These were the coldest February and September for more than 6 decades. In Afghanistan, experiencing some of the worst drought over 6 decades, and in the neighboring countries, the fields are flooded. So it's not only global climate change warmer. It is the extremes. We will see much more extremes in the future, and that requests that our crops need to be much better buffered against extremes in climate. This here was a real interesting study because it looked not forward, it looked back. It took data and looked back what was the impact on global climate change over the last 30 years on the major crops, maize, rye, wheat, and soybeans. And interestingly enough, if carbon fertilization is not considered, then in theory the yields for wheat should have suffered most, by 5%. Rice was basically not affected. Maize is also very sensitive to high temperature, which was recently shown also in a study which involved CIMIT. And soybean again was not very much affected. However, if you consider the carbon fertilization, there was for the C3 crops, 3% yield increase was given. In this case, maize suffered most. Rice, as a matter of fact, benefited. And wheat had a loss of about 2.5%. Now, all the models which I am aware of predict by 2030 the carbon dioxide content is so high that wheat will not benefit any further. So then really the losses from heat increases will come in. Also very interesting that global climate change has already contributed to price increases. With carbon fertilization, that is the reality, 6.4, if that had been excluded, it would be nearly 20%. And Mala has pointed out very clearly that the different models really have a tremendous variation, I agree. But some of the models which are used in the wheat community are from CSIRO and NCAR. And they show that in irrigated wheat regions of the world, the losses are, without carbon fertilization, about 28 to 34%, and with carbon fertilization, between 20 and 27%. Most of the irrigated wheat, more than 90% of all irrigated wheat is in developing countries. So again, the problems are there. Interestingly, however, the rain-fed areas for wheat are much less impacted. Okay, and this here is it now in a nutshell what we are challenged for with in terms of global production. You can see here the black line. This is an extrapolation of our current trends. The green line is what IFPRI and FBO have calculated we need to achieve in order to feed the population without having tremendous price increases. The red line is an extrapolation of what happens if we continue business as usual. The potential effect of the climate change, the heat stress, and also the increasing pressure from diseases will bring down the yield potential. So we have to bring it up, and that is policy, agronomy, and breeding, the three interventions, and I would like to talk now for the rest about some options in this area. So where will productivity increases come from? One third from agronomy, and initially more from agronomy. Agronomy has been an ignored science in many countries for the last 20 years, and today many of the rundown soils are a consequence of it. So that needs to change. Secondly, breeding. Of course, I mean, breeding will then provide the cultivars which can utilize the inputs better. And certainly we need the right policy. And just to illustrate this a little bit, we have developed to compare the cars sector with the plant production sector. We have produced cars which are very nice, very efficient, very fast, and we provide them excellent roads to really utilize them. We have developed beautiful wheat varieties, and then we grow them in miserable conditions. I mean, this is like putting this car on top on an unpaved road. That needs to change, and we need the investments in agronomy. We need to provide them the optimum environment to utilize the potential. This light here shows you, this is the optimum condition, same variety than down here. This is farmer practices, and this is using the technologies we know. So this is what can be achieved through better agronomy. And the other area where we also need to work very hard with small farmers is moving in the area of precision agriculture. We can provide cell phone messaging. CIMIT has a project in India where we have now nearly 50,000 customers where information about climate, coming diseases, prices are provided. We have to target the delivery of information related to this, market prices, to enable the farmers to make informed decisions. And there is computer-based information and knowledge systems available to rural farmers. And we also have to provide location-specific knowledge on the products. So that is under the way, and I think it is very feasible that even smallholder farmers can benefit from precision agriculture. The Pollock Institute of South Africa, a major challenge for it will be to modify and adopt the existing technologies to smallholder farmers. This is a very important intervention, and it will contribute at least, I think, 20% to the 70% we need to make. Let me talk now about what we want to do about yield potential. If you look at the traditional increases, this year are from different regions in the world, Mexico, Australia, UK, India, average on the world. For the last 4 years or so, the average was about 0.91%. That is yield potential. And we really have to differentiate between yield potential and yield increase, because other factors also contribute, as I mentioned, better agronomy and better disease resistance. This here is a recent analysis, where we compared the elite lines which CIMIT distributed over the last 35 years, and there we came up with a yield gain of about 0.9% in this over this period. So we don't see really a slowdown in experimental plots, in breeders' plots, in yield potential. There is a lot of talk about slowing down yield potential in farmers' fields, no doubt about it. But we haven't observed it really in breeders' plots, and I'm very optimistic that we can continue to maintain a raise in yield potential over the coming years. Another area is really heat and drought together. There is a lot of talk about drought tolerance. There has been not so much efforts on breeding for heat tolerance in wheat. Even so, when you really look at it, heat and drought very often occur in the same environment, and they basically affect the same processes in the plant. I mean, both shorten the life cycle, both impair the metabolism, both have problems with nutrient deficiency. There is less photosynthetic tissue. There is florid sterility, reduced grain quality, and there are also biotic stresses, in particular soil-borne diseases, another area greatly ignored, and if we invest more in that area, there we can get another 5 to 10% yield gains on a global scale. And then heat, of course, is a reduced wheat water harvest, and drought causes the dehydration. These are the main two things which are different. For heat tolerance, we have validated traits which are really functioning, like canopy cooling, membrane thermostability, fertility of florets, delayed senescence. We have cultivars which are more tolerant, heat tolerant than others. That we know there is genetic variability. But in order really to make the progress, we have to look into other traits where much, much less results are available. In summer, for example, one area which has not been addressed so far, to my knowledge, is tolerance to high night temperature. In Obregon, at our principal breeding station, the correlation between the minimum average temperature in January and February, that means the coolest temperature in the night, and yield is about minus 0.92. So it's really the high night temperature which causes tremendous problems for increasing yield in wheat. We have to increase the Rubisco specificity. Rubisco is the main enzyme for photosynthesis, C3. Wheat is a C3 crop, very, very inefficient compared to other crops, and we started in this area. There is Rubisco activase. We have to change the plant architecture. If we want to produce 70% more yield, lodging resistance becomes a very big issue again. We have to also consider the photoprotection, starch synthase, Urea started to convert rice into a C4 crop. At CIMMYT we also look into this, as and I will come back to it in a moment. And just also looking at the combined effect of heat and drought. This slide here illustrates the yield progress which has been made over the last 50 years. Now, I didn't want to show this one here, but what I really wanted to show is something happened there in these years. And I asked our agronomists, and what it really was, it was La Niña. These were wet years, cloudy years. Now, if you see here this response from wheat, this is in Obregon, it shows you how sensitive wheat is really to radiation and temperature. And this was very, very well mapped. I personally looked up the data because I couldn't believe it first. I thought something else went wrong, but it can really be extremely well mapped. So, where will we get the yield potential increase of 70% from? We have to look into the photoprotection, increase the water use efficiency. We can have leaf wax, pigments, and antioxidants. Again, a wide field for additional research. We have to look into the transpiration. We need much more efficient leaf photosynthesis and spike photosynthesis. Matthew Reynolds, this slide is from him, has worked a lot on it, and he has reported now considerable variation for spike photosynthesis, and this is an area which we need to exploit further. Then also the partitioning, the harvest index, has gone down in the last years. I mean, we were breeding for higher yield potential, and consequently the plants got a little bit higher. That needs to be fixed again. And finally, the water uptake, we have to come to faster ground cover and assess water by roots. The areas for photosynthetic intervention, Stephen Long has looked into this, and he calculated the potential gains from changing the photosynthetic efficiency in three crops, C3 crops. And here you can see the impact for Rubisco, increased conductance, all these areas. It's between 5 to 100%. But what I want you to focus is on the right side. This is the time needed to have the first results on it. And it's varying between 5 and 25 years. And I want to make a point here. If we really want to raise yield potential, we have to increase our investments much faster. Phil Pardy from the University of Minnesota has published that from the invention of a technology until it reaches farmers' fields, it takes in the U.S., in the United States, on average 20 years. Now, I don't think that other countries and other farmers will pick up new technologies faster. So we really talk about this gap of about 20 years. How can we break the yield barrier? Well, I just said we have to form a wheat, CIMMYT started to form a wheat yield consortium. It is based on Rubisco optimization. It has to increase the zinc demand. We have to improve the lodging resistance. In breeding, CIMMYT is also going to establish a breeding program for yield potential. The annual budget for this is estimated at about $7 million. And also, we are engaging in public-private sector cooperation to develop hybrid wheats. The program focusing on yield potential will be based on trait and marker-based breeding. Genomic selection will be becoming a very important part of it. We also have to expand wide crossing and enhance photosynthetic capacity. We have to exploit the genetic gene pools, exotic gene pools, much, much better. And then certainly we have to deliver this material very efficiently to national programs. In summary, so where will the 70% now come from? First of all, for breeding, germplasm sharing. I really emphasize this because there are a lot of trends that germplasm sharing and exchange becomes controlled. I think it will be counterproductive for raising wheat productivity. In the past, 50% of all progress came from sharing, and I hope we can maintain this. International testing, CIMMYT works with about 250 breeding programs around the world, and these make data available which help us to identify the best lines. That also needs to be maintained. Conventional breeding will be the basis for increase. Better and durable resistance, exploitation of distant gene pools, for example, window by spring crosses. And we also have to utilize molecular tools on a much larger scale in weed improvement. We have to utilize the genetic resources much better. A few translocations, 1A, 1R, 1B, 1R, have basically made an impact on global wheat production. There are many more translocations out there which we need to transfer into adapted background to see their effect, and CIMIT is working very intensively on this. I have talked about the application of physiology, and we also have to work really on hybrid wheat. CIMIT is engaged in this. If hybrid wheat becomes a reality, it will also attract more funds from the private sector. For your information, currently the global investments in maize are possibly 4 to 5 times higher than in wheat. Considering that the maize breeders only, I think, make 2.5 times faster yield increase than wheat, wheat breeders are still doing pretty good considering the low investments. And finally, we also have to get serious about transgenic wheat. There is no transgenic wheat released anywhere in the world. I think this is a problem, and whether this can be changed or not, we have to see. But CIMIT is very much engaged in transgenic wheat research also. Agronomy I have mentioned, and policy I have mentioned also. And finally, I would like to make the last point is that we really have to start to look into our genetic resources. CIMIT and Dicara together have about 200,000 accessions in our gene banks, and we really don't know what we have. The Mexican government has made available about $5 million per year now to really unlock the information which is in the wheat genome, and over the next 10 years we would like to sequence all accessions in our gene bank and make this data available so that can be used by others for allele mining. The potential which came out of genetic resources is shown in this slide. This here are the results of synthetics. The work on synthetics started more than 30 years ago when the AB and the D genome was recombined again. And what you can see here is that these synthetic-derived lines have a much better root system under drought conditions. Green shows here the water which is left at antithesis, and blue under drought, and the same under maturity. I think there is tremendous, tremendous treasures out there in our genetic resources, but we need to utilize them, and that will be, again, long-term research. Finally, this is my last slide. This here are countries which frequently release sister lines. And I think CIMIT germplasm, starting with Norman Borlaug, has built allelic blocks which are really in the position to cope with extremely different environments. And the new molecular tools will now enable us to keep these allelic blocks together, and I think they will be the basis for wheat cultivars which can cope with the challenges ahead of us, and we also can incorporate the genes which are needed to raise the yield potential. And this one is what Norman Borlaug said in 1970. Future food production increases will have to come from higher yields. And so I have no doubt yields will keep going up. Whether they can go up enough to feed the population monster is another matter. Unless progress with agricultural yields remains very strong, the next century will experience sheer human misery that, on a numerical scale, will exceed the worst everything that has come before. We are now there, and I think the world has to make now a decision whether we want to increase the investments in wheat research or not. With the current business as usual, we will not make the 70%, and that will have a big consequence.